This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. The rise of ISIS and the recent terrorist attacks in Paris and San Bernardino have a large number of Americans fearful of future attacks in the U.S. And that fear, along with political rhetoric, misinformation, and a basic lack of knowledge about Islam, has caused some people to unjustly point to all Muslims as a threat. Greater Cincinnati's home to a large, diverse population of Muslim Americans. Many of them are worried this fear and a lack of understanding are fueling discrimination and violence toward Muslims. Joining us to discuss the Muslim community in Greater Cincinnati are Council on American Islamic Relations Cincinnati Executive Director Karen Dabdoub, Chaplain for the Muslim Student Association at the University of Cincinnati, Amina Darwish, and from Clifton Mosque, Imam Ismail Chartier. And you can join the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Ismail, Amina, and Karen, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having us, Mark.
Karen, there's a fear because of these acts of terrorism in the Islamic State. There's a lot of political rhetoric flying around out there and a lot of misinformation. Yeah. So I'm wondering, Karen and Amina and Ismail, what are the three of you seeing in terms of how all this is affecting Muslims, and what are your concerns right now?
Well, I think, first of all, as Americans, we're all affected by the terrorism as well. You know, we're fearful for perhaps going out to large public gatherings and places like that. And then at the same time, because we see that the Muslim community across America is also coming under attack, then we're also afraid of fellow Americans attacking us because of our faith. So it's kind of a double whammy, really.
Yeah, I look at it as we're between, you know, a gun and a gun kind of idea. We have Daesh on one side, and then we have, you know, ultra-white, you know, white supremacist racists on the other side, who are both coming at the Muslims. ISIS and has killed more Muslims than they killed anybody else. And now we have this rhetoric coming from the right that is really putting us between more than a hard spot and a hard spot. It's become quite dangerous and concerning for a lot of Muslims.
Daesh being the word that they don't like to be called.
Thank you for
that. And that's the reason we use it.
Okay. it's an insult?
So it's like an acronym. It's like ISIS, but it's the acronym in Arabic. And they've like, oh, we've expanded. You can't call us that anymore. And we're like, no.
Well, and in the Arabic-speaking countries, it's used because there are – if you just slightly modify the word, it becomes an insult. And it rhymes with a lot of words that are insulting. And so in the Middle East, that's the word that's used along with some of the rhyming words and things like that. And they hate it. And we love it.
Yeah. There was also a lot of
– because of that.
There were a lot of Arab comedians that really just made tons of videos just mocking them. And that word just stuck to make fun of them. And that's – yeah, it's a word people use to mock them.
And I think that's important, Karen, to point out that – you're not supportive of these guys in any way, shape, or form.
Oh, absolutely not. There's nothing Islamic about this so-called Islamic State. You know, when you say something is Islamic, you say it's according to the religion of Islam. But killing innocent people couldn't be further from what our religion teaches. You know, our religion teaches that if you take one innocent life, God considers it as if you've taken the lives of all of humanity. And we believe in accountability on the Day of Judgment. So, you know, that's a really serious thing. And contrary, you know, on the flip side of that, it also says that if you save one life, it's as if you save the lives of all of humanity. So that's what, you know, part of what our religion teaches us. And so what Daesh is doing is killing lots and lots of innocent people, mostly Muslims, and terrorizing entire communities and actually terrorizing the entire world, or attempting to. So it's very, very frightening for Muslims as well.
I mean, how concerned are you about discrimination against Muslims because of what groups like this are doing?
Sadly, a lot more than I want to be. And that's, I mean, we were talking about the terrorist attacks. It took a lot out of me to actually share the story. My cousin had moved to New York right before 9/11. Our family was affected by it. Thankfully, they were all okay. They couldn't find her daughter for like 12 hours. And then even when they did find her, she went to school across the street from the World Trade Center.
Oh, my gosh. So she was that close?
She was that close. Thankfully, they found her. Her husband was actually on the steps of the North Tower when the first plane hit. It was this... I mean, we're getting the news of, like, we're okay. We don't know where she is. Finally, it took us a whole day to find out what had happened and that she was okay. My cousin's a doctor. When they finally found her daughter, she couldn't leave the hospital to go pick her up. Her husband had to go by himself. So I just, we dealt with that. And then on the flip side, we're dealing, because the rest of my family actually lives in D.C., and we're dealing with the backlash of, like, who are the Muslims that live around the Pentagon? Who are you? All these things. And it's like, we don't know who these guys are. If we knew, we would say, this is my family. Like, how dare you come here and do this? How dare you come to our home and do this? And it's the same outrage, except instead of being a part of the solution, being allowed to be part of the solution. Because if anyone knows who the weird guy that showed up is, it's the Muslims. Like, we know everyone,
and on that
we weren't
same
given
day,
that opportunity. Instead, we were given the third degree of, like, how did you not know? Like, if we knew, we'd say, we don't want these people here either.
And on that same day, at that point in time, I was working at the Islamic Center in Westchester. And so at the same time that I'm dealing with, as an American, with the shock and horror of what's going on, we started receiving death threats. And we had to have a police presence there for months afterwards. So it was very, very frightening, and something that I never, ever thought that I would see as an American, that fellow Americans would threaten me or, you know, other people like me because of our religious affiliation when we've done nothing wrong.
And Amina, what about on the UC campus? Are you seeing any kind of backlash there against Muslims?
There was one, and this is the thing. I can't wrap my head around the fact that this is happening on a college campus. One of the students was crossing the street, and a car started speeding towards her.
After they called her a terrorist and cursed at her. And
Her three friends pulled her off the street and basically saved her life. This car would have rammed her, and this happened at the Starbucks across the street from campus. And I feel like I'm going through, like, I'm hearing this and I'm like, that's not real. But it is. And we have to deal with it. And there's just so much hurt of we're trying to fix this and I'm trying to work on it. And this is what we're getting instead. It really feels like I'm being stabbed in the back of, like, hey, I need to work on this. We all need to work on this. This is evil. They're trying to divide us and you're letting them.
513-419-7100 if you would like to join the conversation. And let's talk with Robert in Clifton. Good afternoon, Robert. You're on Cincinnati Edition.
Hi. Thanks for having this conversation. I'm just wondering whether your guests are offended by the possibility that the media is presenting this as a Muslim terror attack when there are other religious attacks that take place or acts of terror. The previous week in Colorado Springs, it may be described as evangelical Christian who did the mass murder at the Planned Parenthood. The Unabomber you could describe as a secularist who did acts of terror. And I just don't think it's fair to... I understand you're just saying that you don't even think this is Islam-inspired, but is it fair for the media to try to make it seem like it's all has to do with ISIS? And the other thing is, to me, the gorilla in the room is guns, and whether the availability of guns and assault rifles really is the problem. In other words, religious zealots don't kill people. Guns kill people, if you ask me.
Robert, thank you for the call. We appreciate it. And let's let the panel here have a comment on this.
I'm from Colorado, and I used to go and give religious sermons in Colorado Springs, and there is a extremist view of Christianity that kind of comes out of Colorado Springs. And to not have that be called a terrorist attack when it is exactly the definition of a terrorist attack, you know, and whenever we have lone white men, and I'm a white guy, I'm an Irish guy, whenever we have white people performing acts of terrorism, all of a sudden it's just a lone wolf. Right?
Or he's mentally unstable.
But that same courtesy is not given to the Muslims. Those people are unstable mentally. Anyone who can pick up a gun, go into a place and kill people or strap a bomb to their back or whatever it is, those people are unstable mentally. They need help. And I do agree that the problem is guns. Something is wrong with a society where you can go and buy, you know, five AR-15s and thousands of rounds of ammunition in an afternoon at a gun show and go out about your business. And to me, that's something that is flawed within our system that needs to be looked at.
Yeah. And, you know, when we do an analysis of
media stories of terrorist incidents or, you know, mass killings and things like that, the only time the perpetrator's religion is mentioned typically is when that person happens to be a Muslim. But when a terrorist incident is committed by somebody who's not a Muslim, then somehow their religion is never mentioned. And when we look at the FBI statistics on terrorist incidents, that shows us that, you know, the vast majority, over 95% of terrorist incidents are committed in this country. Domestic terrorism is committed by people who are not Muslim. And so while, you know, I would rather that it was, 0% Muslim, that's the way it should be. But again, I don't think that, you know, bringing people's religion into it is the right way to go, because then, especially with a community like the Muslim community that is not that Americans are not widely familiar with, there it's very easy for them to say, oh, well, it must be because of their religion. And then when we call it Islamic terrorism or Islamism or Islamic State and things like that, we are attaching the name of the religion to this crime when the religion itself does not justify it.
Karen, what do you think overall of the way the media portrays Muslims? Is it fair and accurate?
Largely, no. But, you know, they're just reporting what's out there. And a lot of what we hear is actually coming from the government. And it's a mixed bag, to be sure, you know, because there are, places, segments of the government that are, you know, doing a good job and really trying to reach out and recognize the diversity of our communities. And then there are other times when that is not the case. And, the finger is pointed at our religion when it's an individual and their, you know, mental illness or instability or warped way of seeing things that's actually to blame.
I think the media is completely complicit in this. And we're not the first group that has been dehumanized. Anytime someone that is black commits a crime, it is their race is mentioned. Anytime someone that's Muslim commits a crime, their religion is mentioned. Those two things are not related to them committing a crime. Every group of people has its good and its bad because we're all human. And I feel like the whole system of doing that is just dehumanizing one group over another and saying, these are the other, this is the us. There is no other. It's all just us. It's not us and them. There's no them. We're all American. It's only us.
Well, we seem to dehumanize people of color and people of color and Muslims, but then we humanize white shooters. So if you go and you look at how some of the press has reported, like the shooting in Colorado Springs, they said he was a quiet guy that was good to his neighbors, right? And then you look at how they report everybody else, all of a sudden they're, you know, they were vicious, horrible human beings. What quiet guy that was kind to his neighbors goes in and shoots people in a Planned Parenthood? So I think there's culpability on the side of media. If there's a big, great movie, if you ever have 9 minutes to spend on YouTube, it's called Planet of the Arabs. And it's based on a book called Real Bad Arabs, R-E-E-L, by Sami Haddad. And he goes through it, and it really shows media prejudice towards Arab and Muslims. We're always depicted as terrorists. Even before any terrorist attacks on American soil, we were depicted as terrorists. We were depicted as the evil that needs to be plagued out and pushed out of the world. So take the 9 minutes to watch that video.
Also, I don't know, there was I don't know if it was CARE that did it or did, I'm not sure who did the study, but they were saying that the incidence of Islamophobia and all of the attacks against Muslims are not actually correlated to terrorist attacks at all. They're directly correlated to presidential elections, what vitriol comes out of people that are running for the highest office in this country, and what the media continues to really, it's playing
on a loop.
So
it's the rhetoric that's fueling it?
I think so.
I think Donald Trump has gotten 35 times more airtime than Bernie Sanders. Right?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
We will continue our conversation. You can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining us to discuss the Muslim community in Greater Cincinnati are Council on American Islamic Relations Cincinnati Executive Director Karen Dabdu, Chaplain for the Muslim Student Association at the University of Cincinnati, Amina Darwish, and from Clifton Mosque, Imam Ismail Chartier. And you can join the conversation, 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Ismail, what causes these terrorist groups to identify themselves as Islamic? What's going on with that?
I have my own view on that. I'm Irish, and my grandfather was in the IRA, you know, the Irish Republican Army. And what the IRA did beautifully was they masked their political cause with religion. So they took this idea of an independent Ireland and they draped it in the clothes of religiosity, and they went to the masses and they said, this is a Catholic war. So you have to join it. If you're truly a Catholic, you will support the Irish independence cause. And people, they did. They joined it left and right. This was what all good Catholics in Ireland are in America who are of Irish Catholic descent. This is what they did. They supported the IRA, right? So groups of extremists in Islam, they've done the same thing. They've taken their geopolitical cause. They've taken their idea of revolution or their idea of wanting to be in power, and they've draped it in the clothes of Islam, and they've used a couple of verses here and there that they think portray them as the ultimate Muslim authorities, right? The spokesman for orthopraxy within the religion. And then they convince the ignorant that this is who they are. Because if you want to be religious, you have to believe like we believe. This is our cause. And the reality is that they're tricking people, just like the IRA tricked people for you know, decades, to think that they were fighting a Catholic cause and they were fighting a geopolitical cause. Just this, the same exact nonsense has just been covered with religion. I have a political agenda. Let's cover it with religion.
I think the main difference here, though, is that the vast majority of Muslims in, you know, the Arab world, for instance, or in Muslim countries in general, do not support Daesh
exactly.
Because they are the main victims mm-hmm. of the violence of this group. So, you know, that's the main difference there.
The Catholic cause was really picked up internationally by a lot of Catholics around the world. This one has not been picked up by Muslims at all, just a few. And if you look at the records of the people who are rushing to join them, they're people who have criminal backgrounds, people who have identity crisis, people who have mental instability in their lives. These are the people who are picking up that cause.
A lot of them are young people who are not educated about what our religion truly does teach and how to practice it. They are people who are alienated by the societies that they live in, you know, in especially in Europe. And so they have, you know, heard this siren call of Daesh, and they've, you know, answered it by some of them by going to join, thinking that they're going to find this utopia. The other thing that we're seeing, too, is that once they get there and they get a very rude awakening as to what it really means to be a part of this organization, and they're trying to leave. And either they are being caught and killed for trying to leave, or they're able to get out and they're bringing us the true story of what's going on and why they realize what a mistake it was.
And that's something. I mean, we did this at the mosque. We called it Misquoting God. And it was a whole series that we've...
Educational series.
It was an educational series. And this is not just something we did. I mean, we actually talk about this. Some of our teachers literally wrote the book on refuting ISIS. Like, there's a billion and a half Muslims around the world. Getting all of the Muslim scholars to agree on anything is nothing short of a miracle. We all agree on this. Like, every major Muslim scholar in the world has signed on to this of, like, we need to change, we need to reclaim this. They don't get to speak for us. They don't get to speak
on Saturday,
for their religion.
70,000 Muslim clerics met in Iraq and put out a fatwa against Daesh. 70,000 from the country of Iraq got together and did this. This is across sectarian lines. So, and literally, like she was saying, my teacher, you know, Muhammad Yaqubi, he wrote a book called Refuting ISIS. It literally is the book to refute ISIS.
And there was a letter that was put out last year and was signed by, I think, about 150 at the time. There's probably more
it's
since
1.6
then.
1.6 million people have signed that letter. Now.
Yeah, but also, I mean, amongst the scholars across the world, initially there were 150 that signed on, and they were refuting ISIS's claim justification for what they're doing. They refuted it point by point by point with evidence from the Quran. So, you know, a lot of times people aren't aware of this kind of stuff because, you know, it's not big news in the media, but it's out there. And I think it is important for people to understand that.
And go ahead, Amina.
And just depending on how big a scholar this person is, they're on ISIS's list.
Exactly. Like, and on their hit list, yeah.
I mean, I was doing, it was a program in Turkey. We had to have security outside the door. One of the scholars, one of his YouTube videos went viral, and it was really debunking ISIS and calling them out for who they are. I mean, they threatened his family. They threatened his children. This isn't a joke. You're sitting in a class, and there's security outside the door because of it.
Yeah, sometimes you hear critics saying that mainstream Muslims are not saying enough against these terrorist groups. That doesn't sound like the case.
No, we're
from what
saying
you're telling
it. They're not listening.
Yeah, no one's reporting it.
Yeah,
you know, we've given at Clifton Mosque. We've given I can't count how many khutbah, how many sermons we've given against this theology, this understanding of Islam. How many classes we've taught in the Misquoting God series. How many times we've gone to churches to talk to people. And I know CARE has done it. I know Amina has done it. We're saying it, and around the country.
And around
Muslims
the world.
Are saying it. Around the world, Muslims are denouncing it. Every major Muslim scholar from Sheikh Al-Azhar, you know, the head of Al-Azhar, to even, you know, the Saudi government just came out last week and denounced
Al-Azhar is a major institution of Islamic learning in Egypt.
Second oldest university in the world. And my parents are moved here from Egypt, so
we would say that it is the oldest because it's continued and it's right. didn't close down.
The oldest is in Morocco and was opened by two women. So the oldest university in the world was opened by two women,
two Muslim women.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Ismail, you know, sometimes you hear the word jihadist mm-hmm. associated with the acts of terrorist violence. Is that what those words actually mean, or is that not accurate?
The jihad doesn't mean holy war or any of these things that people think. Yeah, jihad is actually a struggle against the self. And people who do any kind of struggle, like if you come up with a religious verdict, it's called you did ijtihad. You struggled to come up with a verdict. It's a struggle in striving against yourself to earn the pleasure of God.
Against the evil tendencies that we find within ourselves.
We all have a natural dispensation for evil within us. This is just the reality of being human. We have an angelic side and we have a bestial side. So jihad is to make that angelic side become the norm and that bestial side to be silenced, to live in complete submission to what God has asked us to do. That's jihad. Even after the conquest of Mecca, the Prophet Muhammad, may the peace and blessings be upon him, he said, "This is the small jihad, and it's over. Now we're going to the big jihad, which is against ourselves, to work on ourselves, to become better human beings." So a true mujahid or a true person who is striving and struggling to earn God's pleasure is someone who's trying to be a better person, someone who's trying to be the best they can be in their life.
I think Rumi is the most popular poet in the world, but he was a Muslim scholar, and a lot of, like, his family ran away from the Mongols. Like, his family escaped, and the next day the Mongols showed up and wiped his village off the face of the earth. And part of what he was saying, he was one of the greatest scholars of his time, and he's saying there's good and evil inside of all of us, and war is just the evil magnified. If we can figure out the evil inside of us, and we can figure out the good inside of us, we can figure out how to capitalize on the good and how to push back the evil. And I mean, he's fighting war. And one of my favorite quotes, he said, "I had knowledge and I decided to change the world. And then I had wisdom and I decided to change myself." And really, ultimately, this is what the American spirit is, this diversity of let's celebrate the other, even though they're different from me.
We will continue our conversation after this. You can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining me this afternoon are Council on American Islamic Relations Cincinnati Executive Director Karen Dabdoub, Chaplain for the Muslim Student Association at the University of Cincinnati, Amina Darwish, and from Clifton Mosque, Imam Ismail Chartier. And you can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And let's talk with Joe in Clifton. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me on. I wanted to call in because I actually had the privilege of attending a rally in Clifton that I believe all three guests today were able to speak at. I wanted to thank each of you for doing that. I thought that was a very inspiring event. I thought it was excellent. And that sort
Thank
of
you.
Leads to my question. What role do you expect students and the young people in Cincinnati to try to play to combat Islamophobia and to try to keep Cincinnati a more welcoming place? What do you hope to see on that front?
Thank you. First of all, shout out to Clifton. That's where I live, so thanks.
Okay.
But I just, being on a college campus, everyone there is either voting for the first time in their life or the second time in their life. And there's, I feel like we just need to take the hate out of our political process. And the fact that we're in Ohio means that we actually get to do that. And a lot of groups on campus are now starting to come together. I mean, we just made a list of everyone that some unsaid person has hated on. And it's such a long list of, like, women, immigrants, Muslims, blacks. Like, you just, the list is so long that
Hispanics.
It was so
gays,
unifying.
Immigrants. Yeah.
That it's, hey, there's more of us than there is of the hate. And it's just, we're going to kill them with kindness. We're all going to show up and say, hey, one of my favorite lines of poetry, it's like, I'm like incense. The more you burn me, the more I'm fragrant. Keep it up, and we're just going to keep getting stronger and getting closer and building more bridges.
I think for the youth, it's important that you mobilize yourselves and you realize that you are not the future of this country. You are the now of this country. And if you don't grab this opportunity and really run with it and really say, we are going to shape our future, we are going to shape the way this country is going to move from this point forward, this is your time. My time is over. I'm 42. My time for political activism, and it's not over, but it's not the height that it should be. You guys are now the ones who are going to be leading us. You are the ones who are going to be pushing us into the next generation. You have to stand up for what you believe in. You have to fight what is wrong with this country and defend what is right with this country and make it the country that you want. And you have to do that by starting collaborations with people, working with those who are underserved and underappreciated in this country, and really making this the utopian ideology that we thought of when it was founded. And I think that rests solely on you guys as youth, because we've all tried it and failed. So now it's
no
you.
Pressure.
I'm glad you clarified that too when you said your time is over. You were talking about politically, because I thought, I'm a lot older than you are. So if your time is over, my time is really over.
That's what I was thinking.
Well, in 91, I voted for Bill Clinton. Or 92, I voted for Bill Clinton. And that was like my generation's leap into politics, right? Was this Bill Clinton vote. He played a saxophone. We all thought he was ultra smooth. But that was when we decided we were going to, like, take over. Like, we were going to take – we wanted change. And then Obama came. That was the generation that wanted change. Now it's still we need change. But we need young people to be involved. We need young people to be involved.
And it's actually the younger generation that gives me a lot of hope, because I see among them much more an embracing of diversity and reaching out to people who are different from themselves, building collaborations and alliances through social media, reaching out not just across our country but across the world. And the world has become a smaller place because of it, and that gives me a lot of hope.
I was at the Adams Center in D.C., which is a big mosque in D.C. this weekend, and Martin O'Malley came and spoke to the community there. And he brought the attention to the youth. He said, if you go and you look at anyone under the age of 35, you're not going to see hate. You're not going to see racism. You're not going to see you're not going to see bigoted ideas towards homosexuals or towards minorities. And so that you guys are our future.
Yeah, no pressure on that. But I mean, I agree. This is their moment. We need to pick it up, run with it. And then part of it is building the coalitions. But other parts of it are actually really simple. I had just having coffee with someone or having lunch with someone and sitting across the table from just eating with someone that is very, very different and having a conversation of what does it feel like to be a transgender person in your community? How are you treated in your religious community? What does it mean for you to be Hindu and to come here and you being practicing or not being practicing? Those are the moments in my life that are the most enriching, of sitting across someone that is very different from me and appreciating their humanity. And I feel like that's really what just keeps the movement going, of sit down, find someone that's different from you, be their friend.
Karen, what are some of the efforts locally, going back to what Joe was saying in his call? Mm-hmm. What are some of the efforts locally? You had the event today, or that he was referencing. I think the event at Fountain Square was today at 12:30. What are some of the events and efforts locally that non-Muslims can go to where they can learn more about the religion, more about the Muslim community?
Yeah. Well, you know, the mosques, both the mosque in Clifton and the mosque in Westchester have tour and talk programs. The mosque in Westchester has a monthly open house tour on the first Saturday of every month at 1 p.m. So people are encouraged to call the office there and, you know, let them know that they're coming for that. And we also participate in usually twice a year. We have a 1 month interfaith dialogue series that we've been doing for the last 9 years with in conjunction with Franciscans Network, which is a Catholic lay group. And we've been to congregations all over the greater Cincinnati area, including Northern Kentucky. And, you know, so if, you know, there's a faith community that would like to participate in that, you know, we'd be more than happy to talk to them and see when we can schedule that. So there are a lot of, you know, things that might be going on in your neighborhood. The Muslim youth community at Clifton Mosque, every Sunday morning, they have a program called Project Downtown, where they prepare lunches for people and take it downtown and pass those out. So there's lots of ways to get involved. You don't have to be Muslim, you know, to participate in any of those.
Again, 513-419-7100 to join us, and let's talk with Larry and Price Hill. Hi, Larry.
Hi. I was very heartened by the idea of and it goes right to my point, of meeting people that are of different cultures and different faiths from you. I work for the post office, and I worked over in the west side of town, and I'm over in Mount Washington now. I come in contact with Muslims every single day on my route, of a variety of different sects and from different parts of the world. When I was registering my child for school, in the line that we were in, a lot of the people were, I mean, there were people from Egypt, from Ethiopia, from Iraq. They brought food for us, and I think it's impossible to dehumanize people that you are able to come in direct contact with. And I think that that's almost the most important thing for people who are ignorant of Islam or of the Muslim culture in general. I think that that's the most important thing, is to actually have face-to-face contact with them. I mean, I've been fortunate enough to have just incidental contact, not even looking for, but just in my everyday life. But I think that, you know, even if you have to seek it out, I think that that's the most important thing, is that you can't dehumanize people in general that you can put a face to.
Yeah.
Thank you for the call. We appreciate it.
Yeah, Larry makes two really good points there. One is the diversity of the Muslim community in America. It is actually a microcosm of the Muslim community across the world. And so people think sometimes that Muslims are all Arabs or all Arabs are Muslims, and actually neither one of those is true. The Muslim community across the world and in America is about 30% from South Asia, about 15 to 20% from the Arab countries, about 30% African American, and then the rest, a variety of backgrounds, you know, European American, like myself and the Imam, African, Eastern European, Central Asian. So it's a very, very culturally diverse community.
And somebody from an Irish Catholic family.
Yeah, so. Even that.
I always say that our mosques are the most diverse place in the country after airports.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Yeah. I would like to take this opportunity to invite anybody who's interested in meeting Muslims and finding out what we are to just come to the Clifton Mosque and come down, you know, 3668 Clifton Avenue and just meet us and just come in. We'll show you around. We'll show you what we're doing. We'll explain our religion to you. I'm there a lot. And if I'm not there, Amina's there. And if she's not there, somebody's there. We can always welcome you in and have a cup of tea or a cup of coffee. I prefer coffee. And we can just get to know each other.
Yeah, and that's the other really important point that Larry brought up, is that when you get to know somebody as a real human being, it's a lot harder to demonize them or dehumanize them. And that's a lot of what we see going on out there, you know, in social media and things, some of these really, really hateful comments and things that we see. You know, we're talking about real people, individuals, moms and dads, grandmas and grandpas. I'm a grandma. You know, teachers, cab drivers, lawyers, engineers,
doctors,
nurses. These are real human beings in our communities. And, you know, when you actually get to meet somebody who's a Muslim, you'll find out that they're just real people like everybody else.
We will continue our conversation after this, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, and joining me this afternoon are Council on American Islamic Relations Cincinnati Executive Director Karen Dabdoub, Chaplain for the Muslim Student Association at the University of Cincinnati, Amina Darwish, and from Clifton Mosque, Imam Ismail Chartier. And you can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Karen, how many Muslims are there worldwide?
Well, I believe the number is somewhere north of 1.5 billion with a B. It's the second largest faith community in the world.
What about in Cincinnati? Do we know how many are in Cincinnati?
It's hard to know because our U.S. Census doesn't ask for religious affiliation. Our estimate is somewhere in the neighborhood of 35 to 45,000, but it's hard to know for sure.
And how many mosques in Cincinnati?
About 12 in the greater Cincinnati area.
And what's the oldest mosque?
Clifton.
Yeah,
okay.
Actually. Yeah.
That's the oldest.
When was that founded?
It was founded in the early 60s, 1968 mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. 70. They founded it in a house. And
actually, they used to gather in one family's basement.
That was in the early 60s.
Yeah, in the early 60s. And then their house got, you know, because they lived in the house got too small for the number of people. And so they bought a house on Fairview Avenue and used that for a while. And then when the community became too large for that, they bought the property on Clifton Avenue.
513-419-7100 to join us, and let's talk with Asif in Westchester. Good afternoon.
Afternoon, Mark. Thanks for taking my call. Thanks to the guests and talking about a very important topic. It's not really a question. It's more of a comment. I wanted to get everybody's thoughts. It's more something that's been on my mind, on my chest, and my wife, who's from India, and she's Hindu, and I'm Muslim, and I'm from Pakistan. So one of the thing that Donald Trump said about banning Muslims to come to the U.S. It's the media. We talked about the media. That's their job to report whatever's going on. The politicians have their own hidden agenda and all that stuff. But what my biggest concern and disgust was the amount of applause that was received by when Donald Trump said that. That kind of set with me. You know, when I came to America in 1998, 1999, I was told about the American values and whatnot, and which was very close to my heart and still is and will be for a long time for the rest of my days. But when you hear this applause and people commenting and saying such things, that kind of, you know, upsets me in a way that it's kind of disappointing to hear that after living here for so many years and investing my life in this beautiful country. And I just wanted to hear from you guys and also unfortunately, there's a lot of people that are not listening to this program, and they have those kind of feelings in their hearts. So deep down inside, for me, I would want to sit down with those individuals and talk to them that, you know, what things do you have in your mind that drives you to these feelings that, you know, we can talk about it. Like, I can tell you how I feel. You tell me how you feel. And that's, you know, come to a halfway mark where you don't have those kind of feelings. I just wanted to mention that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Asif.
Yeah, hearing this kind of thing from someone who aspires to the highest office in our land and who whoever is finally elected has to raise his or her right hand and swear to uphold and protect the Constitution of the United States of America. And so to put forth this idea that we as Americans can or should exclude people based on their religious affiliation is not only un-American, it's unconstitutional. And it's very hard to understand how someone who either does not understand and or does not respect our Constitution could be so high in the polls. As far as the followers, the people applauding, you know, I understand that fear and ignorance can lead to hatred, and hatred can lead to this type of thing. And that's, I think, what's very disappointing, is that people will allow themselves to indulge in that fear and ignorance and to, you know, support an idea that marginalizes other fellow Americans. And, you know, my husband is an immigrant. He came here to the United States legally and went through the entire process. So I believe in and support and respect that process. And I don't think that, you know, as a country of immigrants, that those of us whose ancestors came here longer ago than some of our more recent immigrants, that those recent immigrants should be excluded based on their faith. I think that's very wrong.
My grandparents came here in 1952 from Belfast, and they came here literally to escape religious persecution, to try to have a better life for their family. And they held up these American ideals, this idea of freedom, this idea of being able to be who you are. They came here as Catholics, looking for freedom as Catholics. And everyone who comes to this country comes here for a better life, for a better opportunity, for a way to make their family have a better education, to have more income, to do whatever they – to just be better off. And have somebody say, well, that's good for white Christians, or that's good for this group of people, but not for everybody. That limits who we are as a country. That limits what we're willing to achieve. If we limit Muslims, we limit doctors, we limit engineers, we limit people who have built this country's technological infrastructure. If we limit African Americans, we limited ourselves to – we have no cultural identity. If we keep limiting people, pretty soon we get down to it's five of us. It's 10 of us. Everyone else has to wear a yellow star or a pink triangle, and they have to have some kind of identification mark on them so I know they're not me. And it leads us into a, us into a neo-fascist ideology, and it's a dangerous, extremely slippery slope that takes away – freedoms at their fundamental level.
I don't believe Trump was calling for a permanent ban. No, I think he was calling for until we know what we're doing, but it's still
permanent. The rhetoric is always starts out that way.
Definitely, let's ban them.
Yeah, it always starts out that way. Hitler never just came out and said, let's kill Jews. It led that way. It was a point where it was slowly moving.
It
was a gradual process. Mm-hmm. You started out by saying they're not welcome in these areas. So we don't support Jewish businesses. Jews aren't allowed in these areas, in our shops. They can't live with us. And we see this right now with Muslims. Muslims can't shop at my shop. Muslims can't park here. It's a gradual progression to a neo-fascist reality where I'm actually afraid that my children will grow up with tattoos on their arms, or there'll be some kind of neo-American Auschwitz. That's how dangerous I think that idea of banning and databases are.
We had a...
As dangerous... I work with a group of young people. We're very stubbornly optimistic.
I'm not.
I think there's more good than there is bad. There was the rally. They said, oh, we're going to rally against all the mosques in America. There's this hilarious video. This poor woman shows up all by herself, and then the Muslims just hang out with her, and then they hug each other, and then they eat cookies. Mm-hmm. Like, nothing happened. And I understand that the fear is getting drummed up. It only works if you give into it. ISIS is trying to scare everyone. It only works if you give into it. They called Trump ISIS, white ISIS, yeah, which I thought was hilarious. I really love the Daily Show.
Why is that? Because he came out of nowhere.
He uses social media. He's saying we should all scare this group of people. Like it's literally all the same. It's the same hate.
Fear tactics.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And he's using exactly the same thing, and it's there are bigots. They found their rallying cry with this one man.
Mm-hmm. I have to agree that there's more. I believe that there are more good people out there.
That's what I was going to ask you about.
I do believe that.
Do you see some good coming out of this? Is there a silver lining?
History shows us that when the good people stay silent, that evil can take over. Mm-hmm. And so that's, I think, the really important point here is that this is not a time for people of goodwill to remain silent and say, well, I don't really need to speak up because other people are. No, everybody who, you know, is a person of goodwill, needs to speak up at this time and, you know, talk about and act upon what is the best of this country, the best of this nation.
But are you seeing signs that people are starting to rally around you?
Positive? Yeah, we are getting phone calls and emails and letters of support, not tons of them, but enough to help us keep our hope up. But it's really, really important. I don't know, remember who it was that said it, but it was something along the lines of all that is necessary for evil to succeed is for good people to remain quiet.
I flew back from D.C. this weekend, and I sat next to a Muslim sister, a Muslim woman. I didn't know her. We didn't know each other. We were just on the plane together. And there was a guy behind us, and you know, I have to admit that at first I racially stereotyped him. I told this to Karen yesterday. He had on a camouflage shirt, and I was like, oh, great, this guy's going to just be a problem. And he leaned forward and he said, I just want to let you know that if anyone starts a problem with you two, I have your back. So it was, you know, there was that moment of being reaffirmed that America is mm-hmm. good, that the middle of the country is good, and that we need to stand together to defeat xenophobic racist
ideas. That takes
ideas.
Action.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Yeah.
We had an email, a couple of emails asking about the Quran. People have heard some citations about violence against non-Muslims. So there's some concern about that, as well as some of the things I think that I believe might even be in Sharia law.
Mm-hmm.
How do you answer that?
Well, there are always going to be people who are going to cherry pick from the Quran. It's interesting how typically the verses they cite, they misinterpret them. They don't cite the verse before it or the verse after it.
So it's taken out of context.
Typically, yeah. They have to take it out of context in order to give it a negative connotation. A lot of times, you know, the verses that we hear are verses that were revealed at a specific time in reference to a certain conflict that was taking place at that time. And Muslims do not understand, interpret, or apply them, you know, in general, across all times and all situations. The other really important thing I think to know is that in, you know, when we're reading, as Americans, when we're reading the Quran, we're reading an English translation of it. And so when you see the word unbeliever, it doesn't mean non-Muslims, okay? It means people who have rejected belief in God and who are attacking, and, you know, when they're talking about these verses, people who are attacking the Muslim community. And so the verses that talk about fighting are when we are under attack and we're fighting in self-defense. And even when that is the situation, that fight has to be declared by a legitimate government authority. It's not something that an individual or some rogue group can declare for themselves.
I think specifically, that verse was revealed in an incident. There was a peace treaty between the Muslim community in Medina and the people in Mecca. It was broken because there were Muslims that were slaughtered in front of the Kaaba. This is the holiest place, both to the pagans of the time and to the Muslims. And it was the number of people that were killed in that entire thing is less than 10 people, and they were war criminals. And out of the war criminals, some of them came back and said, I'm sorry, I won't do it again. And they were let go. Like, I mean, if the Third Reich shows up and says, hey, we're sorry, it doesn't make sense to accept their apology. That is actually what happened. The number of people that were killed after it were so few, there was barely any fighting.
And for people who want to really know the Quran well in an English understanding, there's a new book that just came out called The Study Quran that was 10 years in the making, and they went through over 50 different explanations of the Quran to come up with their explain to show you what it really means. And they've done a very excellent job. I've read it. I think it's a very excellent book, especially for non-Muslims to read to see what we believe. So it's called The Study Quran. It's like the Harper Study Bible. It's done by Harper's. It's by a prominent scholar here in America named Sayyid Hussein Nasser. And about 50 scholars together worked on this work in English for English-speaking people. So it clarifies all of these misconceptions that people have. They can also go to our YouTube channel at Clifton Mosque, and they can watch the Misquoting God series where we took on these verses in particular and explained what they mean.
Ismail, Amina, and Karen, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you. It was our pleasure. I'll speak to both of you.
Council on American Islamic Relations, Cincinnati Executive Director Karen Dabdoub, Chaplain for the Muslim Student Association at the University of Cincinnati, Amina Darwish, and from Clifton Mosque, Imam Ismail Chartier.
Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition. Archives of our programs are available at WVXU.org. The producer for today's show was Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer was Belinda Kai. And the technical director was Kevin Rawinski. I'm Mark Haney.